This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Matt Colkin from Appian.
Hello, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here. Appian is a low-code provider of automation. And automation is the unifying of the different factors of work, like people, RPA, AI, and rules, within one workflow so that they can work in coordination.
I'm not sure that I'm fully sold on the unification argument at the moment. If I look at a lot of the discussion around AI, we see people being led down a path of fear. AI will replace your job, people will be made unemployed. How do we make that unification in such a way that people understand that it enables their job, it enhances what they do, it doesn't replace them?
It clearly doesn't replace them because each of these factors have different strengths and none of them has anything close to human strengths. Humans make by far the best decisions. We are unfortunately slow and expensive. There are other technologies that could compensate for our sloth and for our expensiveness, but cannot substitute for the things that we're good at. You could take robotic process automation, and you could do a simple task repetitively, quickly, and cheaply. But as soon as it hits an exception, it's done. Cannot overcome the exception. RPA can't be used alone, but in concert with people, it's exceptionally powerful for a broad range of tasks. Alone, it can only do a narrow range of tasks. Artificial intelligence is similar in this regards. It's good at some things, but it can't do the whole job. And it certainly can't do a human's job. It's good at appraising, quantifying, identifying, translating, can do those things. But when it comes to making a decision, it's generally got to go to a human and say, here's what I think you should do. You tell me if that's what I should actually do. We have different factors working with different strengths and also with weaknesses. And we need to work together. We need to complement each other. And we need an orchestration that allows each of them to be brought to bear for their own strengths and not for their own weaknesses. So what we need is all these factors working together in the same workflow.
If we look at many of the successful RPA and early AI deployments, they are very easy for people to visualize. They're the drudgery problems that they have to deal with, or the scenarios where they're completely overloaded. For example, security teams who can't cope with the amount of information they get, they need something to simplify that to a problem that they can now handle. But how do we take the step beyond that and actually look at systems that are able to not so much think for themselves, but actually spot those variances, understand where this RPA has to bring in another one?
First of all, let me say, I don't believe these systems are going to think for themselves. I think that for now and the long term, the thinking is done by people. I know there are those out there who say that AI is going to take our jobs or something. I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think AI is perpetually unqualified to do a human's job and should exist low in the stack doing basic functions like some of the ones you just mentioned. I don't want to have AI do a human's job. In fact, I think we should consciously target it at supportive behaviors. Let's ask, why is it that we haven't done more with RPA? Everybody likes RPA. The valuations have taken off and people are buying bots. And yet, what you said is true. It keeps getting used for absolutely trivial use cases. So why can't we solve a real problem with RPA? And the reason is RPA doesn't handle exceptions. It handles very simple things when used in isolation. A few years from now, no one will use RPA in isolation. It is, if I may say so, the worst way to use RPA. It is so clearly compromised by its inability to handle things that aren't perfect that it should be a member of a team, not the team by itself. What we need to do is pair it capably with human judgment and maybe with AI perception and maybe with rules. But if you put it into a blend and you attack problems in a multi-party way, then you can handle what I would call real problems, as opposed to the trivial problems that you said we were handling with them so far. And you're right. That's all we're doing with them right now because we haven't put the team together to handle the real problems.
The other part of that early RPA work we're doing at the moment is it's spun out of those people who wrote macros in the office. The person who looked at Excel and thought, there's a better way to do this. I can write a macro. Everybody in this team's going to use it. I'll write it and share it. But there comes a knowledge block. When I go back to expert systems in the mid-1980s, a lot of our challenge was actually getting hold of subject matter experts, getting them to explain what they did in order that we could begin to codify what they did. RPA and low-code have changed that. We no longer go out trying to extract that knowledge of the process from the people because we give them tools they can utilize. But to make that next step of linking this, we do require a higher order of abstraction of how we develop. How far away are we and what sort of tools do we need?
I think it's actually very important to collect the expertise from the group. What we're offering here is automation, not merely enhancement of human capability, but really automation. It's the difference between a calculator and a computer. If we gave everyone a calculator, they could do their sums faster. If we gave them a computer, though, they'd be taking some of their expertise about how things should be processed, putting it in the machine, letting the machine do that. It's more empowering if we do move the expertise, and I believe that we should. RPA, certainly, AI even more so, and absolutely process management does rely on a certain degree of conveyance of the rote things that as people we shouldn't be doing anyway. They're not playing to our strengths, but we feel stuck doing them because we can't delegate. This allows us to delegate more and focus.
So let's stay with that subject matter expert problem. The challenge we had in the 80s was understanding the person in order to be able to extract what they knew. People didn't know how to explain it. People didn't know how to ask for it. Here we are in 2020, and I'm not convinced that we've moved much further from people being able to explain what they do and people knowing how to ask what they do. How do we overcome that hurdle to get this collective body of knowledge so that we can move forwards?
Here's how I think you do it. People have a limited imagination about how their expertise will be rendered in a system. And so if you were to just ask them, could you tell me how to do your job so that I could tell somebody else or tell a machine how to do it? They would say, well, I probably can't explain it that well. But if you were to show them a first draft of it working for them and they were to critique it, let's say we wrote a little script that did some of the things they were doing and we said, is this good? And they'll say, well, now that I see what you're talking about, it's 80% good and this 20% is totally wrong. What you need then is a way to quickly mock up and quickly revise examples so that you can get closer to a person, you can get within recognition length of a person, and then they'll understand what it is you're doing. I think actually the subject matter expert process is not a vacuum. It's not just, let me take everything you know and I'm going to move it over here. It never works that way, and people don't express themselves that way, and it's not even translated that way. I think that model just doesn't work. It is instead a conversation, and it is a multi-step conversation with a subject matter expert in which you say, hey, I think I heard what you said. Here it is. And they say, no, that's not exactly what I said. Change it again, and then we show them again, and then we change it a third time. And eventually it approximates what that person knows. It will never duplicate because the difference between the approximation and the human is human's work. And we shouldn't expect a machine to do human's work. We should have the machine do the rote part of it so that the humans can do the communication, the connecting, the judgment, the appraisal of novel factors. That's what humans can do, and I don't believe any machine in our lifetime is going to be able to do those.
But who does that conversation with the end user? If I go back over 35 years in the industry and look at all the different moves I've seen, including things like rapid application development, where we sat people next to the user to understand what they did, we failed again and again and again to truly understand what it was they were doing.
Doesn't that have a lot to do with the fact that it was a waterfall conversation? I'm saying that an agile conversation works better than a waterfall conversation in this context, that you have to keep coming back and speaking the SMEs language.
But is it a technological conversation? When we send IT people out there or business analysts out there to have that conversation, they have it from a technology perspective. Do we need to start reviewing our soft skills in the enterprise and say, well, actually, there is a role for people who have some degree of psychology training here, people who can actually talk to individuals?
Absolutely. The more we emphasize automation, the more we bring out the humanity in humans. The more we let humans be psychologists instead of calculators. That's actually the purpose of all of this. Yes, we're going to need those soft skills, not only because humans are uniquely good at them and cannot be replaced at these skills, but also because that's the way we talk to each other. And as we talk to each other, so soon should we talk to our machines. The most efficient way for a machine to listen would not be to my program, which took an expert degree to write, but to my speech. We've all learned how to speak. We have a way of interfacing with people, a very high bandwidth way. Why is it then that we talk to computers through a keyboard and through an ASCII character set and through a very limited means, which is easy to go wrong with, easy to misinterpret, hard to figure out what somebody else was saying, hard to revise? This is not an effective medium of conversation. We only do it because at this stage in our relationship with machines, we haven't been able to make them listen like a human. We want them to listen like a human.
But for them to listen like a human requires us to do a lot more with programming them to listen like a human. One of the big challenges in machine learning is building the correct level of context. If we're simply talking about a general machine learning solution, the context is well understood of how words relate together. The moment we get into a business environment and we move from industry to industry, we now have words that are unique to that environment, words for which our models have no understanding. So we have to build those highly complex contextual maps. More importantly, we then have to turn those contextual maps into audio maps that the computer can hear, understand exactly what is meant. In English, things like two, two, and two, there, and there. They become an inhibitor to going forwards. Where does that shift have to come from in terms of educating those speech systems?
This is going to be very gradual. We haven't the answer today. It's going to be in steps, but one of the first steps was moving a little bit away from the keyboard and a little bit closer to the mouse. Between the two ways that you can speak to a computer, one of them is far more human. I'd rather draw with a mouse than strike with a keyboard. We're going to do this in small steps. Also, something rendered graphically is more intuitive to a human than something rendered sequentially. A computer takes one character at a time and reads them and processes them as such. A human does not. A human sees much at the same time and perceives it as a connected group. And so we'd like to be able to express ourselves as a connected group, like a flowchart.
But does that mean there's a technology missing in this mix? If we go back to the 1990s, when we first started to see speech systems, we had to use discrete speech. The processors and the memory weren't capable of dealing with continuous speech. Now we have an abundance of processing capability, an abundance of memory. So in theory, the computer should be able to take any stream of speech, break it up using rules of grammar, and turn out something which is coherent. It's a wonderful pipe dream. I would love to be able to dictate to my car when I drive and be presented with this great manuscript at the end of it. What piece of technology is missing?
It's a pipe dream, but you also just described the easy part, not the hard part. The easy part is for a computer to recognize your speech and understand the words that you said. And the hard part would be for the computer to understand in context what actually ought to be done. I'll be impressed when my car asks me a clarifying question. I'll say, I want to go to this, and it'll say, which state? Because multiple states have a Springfield. Or which location would you prefer? Or would you like to enter from the front or the side of Disneyland? When we have a dialogue, see, that's how humans communicate. I'll say something, and there'll be ambiguity in it, and so you'll ask. And we'll get to the truth together by essentially having a shared conception of what it is, and then we focus it together. It's like a dual comprehension of an idea in process. Machines don't do that at all. They only understand what is fed to them in exactly the right way. There's no dual understanding. We have to say it perfect, and when we do, finally, they get it. And they get it in the most limited possible way that extrapolates nothing from what we told them, just that basic thing. That is not mutual understanding. The hard part, therefore, isn't for them to hear us more broadly, though that is also hard, but for them to understand and engage in that human behavior of having a mutual understanding of an idea in process.
But that brings us back to RPA and many of the, shall we say, frankly, misleading videos that we've seen in the industry. The having your coffee in the morning and your digital assistant pipes up and gives you your schedule for the day. By the time you turn the key in the car, the digital assistant has located where you are and is now talking to you through the car. Personally, at this point in time, I'm turning the car off and hiding in a bunker. I do not wish to be stalked by a digital assistant. But the examples that we see go on to, you have this meeting with customer XYZ. Oh, I see you've had the meeting. How did it go? What did they ask for? Did you think about offering them this? They imply a higher order degree of cognitive awareness in RPA. How do we stop this science fiction presentation and get to reality?
If any robotic questioner came on and asked me those questions, I would not answer. I already am a little bit allergic to speaking to robots. When, let's say, I'm called up with an automated message and it thanks me or maybe apologizes to me for how long I'm waiting, it's worthless. I don't care if a machine apologizes to me. It's the subordination of one entity's dignity to another. They had none to begin with. Give me a break, right? They have no capability to be useful questioners today. They could be recorders. They could say, did you meet this person? Were they ill? Is their job still manager, general relations? You could still have that kind of a data gathering but verbal conversation. What you cannot do is have a conversation in which the process of discovery is furthered by the machine's imagination. We're just not there. We won't be a long time. And so, yes, the pipe dream, yeah, basically.
So how then, having acquired an RPA company, do you bring the elements of that into a low-code environment in such a way as you can get the benefits of automating what can be done quickly? of integrating that with core enterprise systems that require some degree of interrogatory conversation to understand what the user wants to do, but at the same time do that with the limitations of today's technology.
RPA is not about the conversation. RPA is not about talking to someone. RPA is for very limited, straightforward tasks done in high volume at low prices in which all variables are compliant with expectations. That's what RPA does. It's not your new digital friend. It is a high volume, low expense processor, a script executor. As such, can convey great value, but let's not misconstrue it. RPA does not talk. All it does is all it's supposed to do, which is emulate human behavior in a scripted fashion in order to retrieve data, send data, write data, or otherwise handle human behaviors. That's what it's supposed to do. And I think that the first thing you ought to do with RPA is focus it on what it's actually good at instead of imagining that it can do everything. The RPA that's good enough to suggest what I should have said to the client I just met is good enough to just do my job anyway. I think I'll just let that RPA do my job as soon as I find it. And in the meantime, our RPA does what RPA is good at, which is just high processing.
Part of the sales process around automation has been about saving money, saving time for people so they can focus on other things. The problem is often the quantification of what has been saved. How much have we invested to get to that point where it's saving something, and how long before we actually have a justifiable return on investment?
This has to do with the investment up front, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which has been a little high on AI, but on RPA it's been lower. It's been shown to be pretty approachable, and people are happy to do scripts just like they would have on that macro you were talking about. They'd be happy to write up a macro. The barrier to entry has been fairly low. On the other hand, we're seeing it unnaturally low because we're looking at the barrier to entry for RPA as an island, which is not the same as RPA, the piston that's firing along with other pistons and moving the entire organization forward. That latter RPA, the coordinated RPA, as it were, is much more expensive, actually, because you have to link it. You have to know when to juggle the tasks. When should RPA do it? When should they not? Where should exceptions go? That RPA is more expensive. It's still efficient, however. It's still affordable. It's still easily within our grasp right now, but it hasn't been quite as viral as the one task RPA in isolate.
Where does the acquisition of the RPA company now take Appian?
It makes us an automation platform, and it makes us the purveyor, the one-stop shop for native functionality across all components of the modern workforce. RPA, of course. Also AI, which we bundle. Also rules, which we've long led in, and also human work, coordinated through our BPM functionality. If you bring these four factors of work together in the modern workplace, then you've got a far more effective way to do genuine, complex work than you would have in the past. We're going to use each one of these factors for their specific strengths and avoiding their specific weaknesses. And while one of those technologies might have only been able to do trivial work in the past, those four technologies paired together and coordinating can handle any work. And so now, instead of being a sidelight, instead of being a script that someone writes in a corner of an IT department, now this is actually how an organization can handle its mainstream and most important tasks. Appian is an automation platform, not for the corner of a department, but for the company as a whole. For the tasks that shape that company's identity, we now have an automated solution and a unified automated platform.
How do we begin to build effectively that library of RPA solutions? Because as I listen to you talk, I think of one very particular problem that I see and have done for the last 10 plus years. Compliance and technology. Compliance sets ever more complicated problems. Committees devolve this into a set of tasks, hand it to IT, who generally just laughs. They do their best effort, but nothing more than that. As we move out to make everybody a developer, or we at least devolve the ability to write code to a wider audience, we want ways to make it easier for them to take on certain tasks and certain items. That leads naturally, as we were talking earlier with RPA becoming a larger thing, to maybe me being able to pull off little pieces of RPA in the same way as I pull off objects if I was talking about coding 10, 15 years ago. Can we get there in such a way that a compliance committee could say, actually, when you handle that piece of information, here's a set of processes that must be met. We can codify that. For somebody sitting in a sales environment who's gathering personal information to be able to say, this is how I want to do my job, this is something I do, and I can now pick off these three pieces of code that sit in there and do that for me in such a way that everybody in the organization knows it meets specific audit requirements, it meets specific legal requirements, and we actually see a massive step forward.
You're outlining very effectively the difficulties in making coders out of the rank and file. It's fast becoming a famous fact that we're going to write as many applications in the next 5 years as we have in the previous 40. An analyst said it, and I've heard it in all directions in the last few months. People are saying this, and I think it's true. There's really two ways to do that. One is that we make our developers much more efficient, and the other is that we make non-developers into developers. You've really got to do one or both. There's also two kinds of low-code. There's the low-code that makes your developers more efficient, and there's the low-code that makes your non-developers into developers. So there's really two legitimate routes to handling this problem, and low-code exists for both of those routes. And I just wanted to clarify that Appian low-code is focused on the first of those two, about making developers more efficient rather than making non-developers into developers, and it's because I agree with you about those difficulties. It's one thing to be able to communicate with a computer, and it's great if you can. It's another to be able to speak logically about exactly what you want, to define a variable logically, to comply with a rule that's been established elsewhere in your corporation. A developer deals in logic. They have to be cognizant of logic and cognizant of data. Where is the data? Where is it authoritative? Where is it efficient to query it? How can I get it quickly? Where is it up to date? You have to be a navigator of data and cognizant of logic to do development. That is why Appian chooses to focus first on developers. The people who have those skills can therefore be accelerated by a good low-code environment. I agree that someday non-developers are going to be more of a developer, but that's not where our emphasis is today.
I'm the CTO of a large organization. I come to you and I say, I like what you're doing. What do I need to do in my organization to get better? And what are you giving me to make me better?
What you need to do is be faster. You need to be faster in a couple key ways. You need to react more quickly to changes in your market. You need to know your customer. You need to know the person you're dealing with right when you deal with them. And then treat them as a human being. Treat them as a specific individual about whom you know something. In other words, you have to act more like a human. As an organization, to please your customers, to stay on top of change in the market, you need to behave more like a human and less like a machine. Now, I know that's a contradictory thing to say, because for the last 40 years, the world's been teaching you to be more and more like a machine. They've said the only way to survive, the only way to cut your costs and to prove a margin, is to act like a machine. And if that means you've lost the human touch, well, so be it, because efficiency matters more. That's what we've been saying for 40 years. We've been saying efficiency matters more than treating your customers as if they are distinct human beings with whom you have distinct relationships. I believe that now is the time that we can finally get back to that objective, which we've left behind, and say, wait a second, it's possible to do both. You don't have to give up efficiency anymore in order to treat your customers like human beings and keep abreast of a changing market. I think now the technology is at your fingertips to create an organization that adapts rapidly, that can rely on software that wasn't written 10 years ago, but maybe 10 weeks ago, 10 days ago. We can have software that is as fresh as the changes in a human mind. At this point, if you're the CTO, you're probably aware, you probably are just pulling your hair out over the age of your software, how difficult it is to maintain, to change it, to keep it secure. You're probably very concerned about the fact that there's nothing in your organization that changes more slowly than your software. You could switch your headquarters. You could switch your logo, anything. You could change your management. You could change anything faster than you could change this old software. It has become the unmodifiable bedrock in your operation, and that's probably frustrating you. I will tell you, it doesn't have to be anymore. We can create software at speed. We can create an application in 8 weeks. We can change software faster than we've ever been able to change software before. And as such, you can keep up with the market. You don't have to be locked in the past with old, immutable software. You can actually be keeping up with modern behavior. And then the other thing is your data, which is separated across probably 100, 1,000 different databases across the company, which is fracturing your knowledge of every customer. Not only is probably every part of it inaccessible at the moment a customer calls you, but there's no way you're going to bring it all together. I'm saying now you can. There's now technology that allow you to know that customer and to deal with them based on what you know within the amount of time it takes to pick up the phone and say, hello, Mr. Wilson.
I think there's a lot of people going to listen to this and think really hard. Matt, thank you for talking with me.
Always a pleasure, Ian.